You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Satan, your kingdom must come down. Satan, your kingdom must come down. I heard the voice of Jesus say, Satan, your kingdom must come down.
Hey there, everybody, and today we're going to be talking about something bigger than Satan, if you will. We're going to be talking about the cosmic fiction and the cosmic horror of weird fiction. So today joining me on the show is going to be Carter Stepper and David Grubbs, but as always, I am Danny Anderson, welcoming you to another episode of the Sectarian Review podcast. So I want to get right into this. Carter, can I begin with you just to say hello? This was your idea a long time ago. Around Halloween, we started talking about this. So what was your idea, Carter, for this show?
Yeah, so back when the Elder Gods still reigned over the primordial mass, I thought this would be a fun episode to do. My thought was weird fiction is such a fascinating form of such a fascinating literary form that sort of overlaps with fantasy, overlaps with science fiction and horror, but is so, well, weird, interesting, different. And it's been a genre I really enjoy for quite some time, and I thought around Halloween time, anyway, it would be cool to do like a vignette show of a handful of these short stories, because it's really a short story form. Mm-hmm. It really only appears in that form successfully, I think. And I thought it would be an interesting and a little bit different take for those of who are used to more conventional horror. Weird fiction is an interesting little subgenre that has some interesting things, I think, for us to talk about. It approaches it very differently. So, I thought it would be fun to do a little short story vignette and talk about weird fiction.
And it's got a great lineage in cinema and other fiction that has spun out of it too. And there's a sort of a modern weird fiction movement even. And so it's a great topic. I do wish it had fallen around Halloween. You know, the thing about podcasts is they just sort of live forever anyway. So people are going to listen to it when they listen to it, but this isn't like radio. So it's not necessarily timely, but yes, the quirks of scheduling three academics to meet together to speak came together on this one. And so it took a little while for us to get there. And so joining Carter and I had to bring the great David Grubbs, the voice of the network. Every time you listen to one of our shows, you hear David Grubbs introducing us. So, David, how you doing, man?
You're listening to the Sectarian Review. I'm good. I'm just delighted to be here. I don't know how long y'all have been reading it, but weird fiction has been one of my companions through life, and I've been stoked since Halloween for this too. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a great genre, and it lives up to its name. It's so odd and sort of off-putting and in kind of really interesting ways in which we'll get together. We'll talk about here in a little bit. I thought what we'd do, so we each have a short story that we've kind of taken charge of and read. David's going to be talking about Count Magnus by M.R. James. Carter's going to be talking about Pigeons from Hell by Robert E. Howard. And I'm going to be taking an H.P. Lovecraft story called Pickman's Model. And we'll talk about them sort of individually. But before we get there, I thought just kind of laying the foundation about weird fiction might be useful. And so who are some like main practitioners? Obviously, the three we're talking about today, M.R. James, H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, are three names that are kind of really synonymous with this. David, do you know, then Carter, like some other names that we should know when talking about this genre?
Lovecraft had a lot of disciples, more or less, younger correspondents that he sort of schooled in the craft, Clark Ashton Smith being one of the main ones. And there were a lot of other writers for Weird Tales and other pulp magazines through the late 20s, 30s, and 40s who sort of picked up on Lovecraft's vein of stuff.
August Derleth.
Derleth being sort of one of the big the big disciple who he really wanted to be Lovecraft's Simon Peter. I don't know whether he achieved it all the time, but that seems to be his hashtag life goal. But also people like Robert Bloch, you know, sort of started off that way, and there is some contemporary horror writers through kind of the middle of the 20th century and into the late 20th century who wrote some of the really iconic horror from that era, who cut their teeth essentially on the Lovecraftian weird tale. But even before that, there's stuff that before Lovecraft, there's stuff that definitely fits, and which is why I picked this particular M.R. James story. But we'll get there.
Yeah. Lovecraft himself, I think, points to Poe as sort of the progenitor of this. And so, yeah, a lot of people will kind of retroactively attach people like him and H.G. Wells to this genre. Carter, anybody stand out to you that's important for us to talk about?
Not as much. I actually am not particularly widely read in weird fiction. I actually came to it a bit indirectly. I came to it through Robert E. Howard's Conan and Solomon Kane stories. So Robert E. Howard's stories are more sword and sorcery kind of stories, adventure stories, kind of like D&D, but in a short story format.
Right.
I read those voraciously, and so I picked up on certain elements from that intrigued me. And then I was seeing Lovecraftian themes actually in other areas of pop culture. So I sort of came to it from the reverse side. I came to it through the long influence, the long tentacles sort of weaving their way through all kinds of other stuff. So, you know, there's a Metallica song about the Call of Cthulhu. So I'm like, oh, what's that? So I kind of came to it indirectly, and I came to Lovecraft later than some of these pop culture echoes that had been left. And I'm like, oh, so this is the roots of this. So I don't know a lot of the other broadly authors that have done it. I'm sort of, these core ones are the ones that I've most read. But I did want to note that the thing about Lovecraft and weird fiction is that it isn't really being written anymore, but it has really widespread sort of effects in all kinds of other areas of pop culture, which I find really, really interesting.
Yeah, you can't imagine like Hellboy, for example, without Lovecraft, yeah. Right? It's like clearly taken right from the Cthulhu mythos, and there are other names that are sort of you know, someone like Guy Endor wrote a famous kind of werewolf novel, the Werewolf of Paris, for which the Hammer Curse of the Werewolf was adapted. So that's a name that gets dropped in here. Daphne du Maurier is another one that gets thrown in. Sheridan Le Fanu. There's some kind of prominent names that are associated with this circle. But I think one of the things that makes it distinctive is that there was a kind of outlet for it. You had these pulp magazines, right, that kind of created a community of readers and writers, and this sort of conversation going over time between them. And I think that's a really interesting feature of one of the things that help it develop almost as an ongoing act of fan fiction. You have this sort of conversation between readers and writers, facilitated largely through these pulp magazines at the time, which were cheap and trashy and really interesting in their own rights. And so, let's get into some generic features. So what is, when we talk about weird fiction, like what, David, I know you and I at the beginning were just bantering about a little bit about Lovecraft. What are some parameters? Like what are some of the main things that make it a distinct thing?
Lovecraft wrote an essay on supernatural horror and fiction. That's the title. And he goes through a lot of the, what he sees as the different distinct tales, the ghost story, the gothic story. But the weird tale is one that he sees as distinct. It's been a long time since I've read this, so I pulled it up, and I think the money quote that you see dropped around is this one. The weird tale has something more than secret murder, bloody bones, and a sheeted form clanking chains according to rule. A certain atmosphere, a breathless and unexplainable dread of outer unknown forces must be present. And there must be a hint expressed with a seriousness and portentousness becoming its subject of that most terrible conception of the human brain, a malign and particular suspension or defeat of those fixed laws of nature which are our only safeguard against the assaults of chaos and the demons of unplumbed space.
Which, yeah.
Like a very Lovecraftian sentence.
Yes. In its self-importance, yes.
When I was in grad school, there was some sort of online quiz where you could enter some of your prose and it'll tell you who you sound like when you write. And I kept coming up with H.P. Lovecraft and it was horrifying to me. And so I apologize to everyone for that. But yeah, go ahead. Carter, any more? Any further thoughts on what kind of makes weird fiction distinct?
Yeah. So, I mean, David has the sort of money quote there, the one that really defines the genre in a sense. In terms of effect, I'd say that weird fiction in particular is meant to be unsettling. It's not a jump scare. It's not even a horror where it's meant to frighten you in sort of a direct, I'm afraid about what's going to happen to this person kind of thing. It's more meant to make you feel this sort of cosmic dread, I guess, like that things, the world is much, is more complex and frightening than anything you could have possibly imagined. And if you were to see even for a moment what reality is like, it would sort of crush you underneath it. So it's got this weird metaphysical sense almost that that we think we understand the universe, but we really don't. And if we were to understand it, it would kill us or drive us crazy.
Yeah.
So there's this dread, this deep-seated dread, I feel like, that sort of defines the genre.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about the way in which you said something about it's not like so much, we're not afraid that something's going to happen to this character. It's like the individual character is almost made irrelevant, right? And that's what's so weird about weird fiction. That's what's so unsettling about weird fiction is that we're all irrelevant in the face of this cosmic horror, right? And that it's more existential, I think, than it is suspense filled, because it whatever happens to this individual is a drop in the ocean towards what's going to happen to all of human life as we know it if all this comes to fruition, right? And so one of Lovecraft's favorite famous quotes from one of his stories is, and I'm paraphrasing, the most merciful thing in the world is that the human mind can't correlate all of its contents at once, right? And so when you get the whole picture, it drives you crazy. You can't cope with the truth of reality in this sort of cosmic universe. And that's what's kind of horrifying about it, right? I recently, and this was unrelated for another project I'm working on myself here, picked up Mark Fisher's book, The Weird and the Eerie, and he's interested in kind of defining these terms as kind of an extension on the Freudian concept of the uncanny, which is a major thing that people talk about with horror. And for him, he says the weird, I want to argue that the weird is a particular kind of perturbation. It involves a sensation of wrongness. A weird entity or object is so strange that it makes us feel that it should not exist or that it should not exist here. So he's really interested in the way there's like an ontological problem set up. Like there is another realm of existence that imposes itself and perturbs our current existence and makes us unsettled about our very conception of what reality is. And I think that's the way I feel when I read Lovecraft or Robert E. Howard. Right. And so, yeah, I think that you guys are totally onto something. Any other features there, David? Did I cut you off too soon?
No. I'm just sort of as I'm, nodding with my mic muted. yeah. Is that the first sentence of Call of Cthulhu that you were?
It's the first sentence of one of the stories. And I think it might be that one.
Yeah. great first sentence.
Yeah.
As I'm nodding silently over here, I was also sort of scrolling down through Lovecraft's essay and reminded of a few more authors that he was reading and referenced. And these are ones that are kind of in that between Poe and his own time. So people like Arthur Machen. Arthur Machen's, especially his short story, The White People, not a modern tale precisely in its meaning. Another one called The Great God Pan, a fellow by the name of William Hope Hodgson, wrote a series of stories about a supernatural detective. Carnacki, the Ghost Finder, also a novel called The House of the Borderland, and another one called The Nightland. And he has a lot of this kind of cosmic things from beyond are invading our space feel to it. Who is the other one? William Hope, Robert Chambers, The King in Yellow, is often cited as, and well, and Lovecraft himself cites it as an influence. Robert Chambers' King in Yellow is sort of the one that gets this idea of the cursed book that drives you crazy when you read it. So Abraham Merritt, his novel The Moon Pool, with kind of subterranean inhuman survivals. Anyway, there's some of these authors in kind of the very late 1800s, very early 1900s, these kind of late Victorian Edwardian writers that are forming part of Lovecraft's reading, and a lot of the tropes that we identify with Lovecraft, he's building on this middle range of authors. They're definitely worth digging into.
Yeah, there's a pretty rich tradition there. And it's interesting. I think it's important to note the time that this emerges. I think that there's a historical reason for it, or it's facilitated at least through historical events. And I think, I mean, I had a friend in grad school who was pretty convinced that, I mean, he kept trying to make the case that this belonged as a form of modernism, that this genre was a modernism. This was, I mean, pretty compelling to me, actually. And Fisher, in his book, he cites China Mieville, who argues, quote, that it was the impact of the First World War, which gave rise to Lovecraft's new, the traumatic break from the past allowed the new to emerge. And I think that there is a sense in which what makes modernist fiction, quote unquote, weird and unsettling is the same kind of approach to the world that makes this fiction weird and unsettling, right? And I think that there is like something going on at that turn of the century moment when everything as we have always thought it was revealed to have been not, right? And I think that this is a particular popular form of dealing with that existential question, and I think that it's a more important thing than a lot of people would give it credit for in that way. I think it's actually wrestling with some really big issues in often very disturbing ways, as we'll get into. But any other thoughts on that, you guys?
Just if I could throw a word out there that I think is also helpful, at least for Lovecraft, and you can push back if you don't see this in him, but I find Lovecraft nihilistic myself.
Okay.
Like the reason you don't end up caring that much about his characters necessarily, you end up identifying with them. He does a great job with sort of every main characters, but he wants you to identify with them, not necessarily care about them. And the reason is, I think, because the whole point is that we don't matter, that human beings are insignificant when faced with reality. And I find that to be ultimately a very nihilistic view of human existence from Lovecraft's perspective. Does that make sense of Lovecraft to you guys? Thoughts on that?
I totally, to me, David.
Yeah. If you read some of his correspondence, he has sort of a a lighter jesting tone when he writes letters, but you'll often find him say things that are very similar to what he says in kind of a cold earnest at the beginning of Call of Cthulhu. A lot of times he'll reference it, he'll sort of tip his hat at Einstein or other kind of cutting edge thinkers of the day that are unmooring the early 20th century man's sense of his place at the center of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And he really does feel himself as in his letters, he'll say things like this. I wish I had some of them in front of me, but I didn't prep that. He will say there's a kind of horror that we can feel now because our world is not making sense in very particular kinds of ways. And the more science tells us about origins and the human creature within the created world and, you know, the science of relativity and all of that stuff, the less and less things are stable, the more and more fear can be about things that aren't just, you know, red eyes glowing in the shadows, but a kind of utter uncentering of all.
Yeah, and that's actually, you guys have given a great answer to the question I was going to ask next, right? And so I think that there is a particular, like, implicit challenge to a Christian vision of creation in this kind of fiction. It's not only challenging in that it's brutal, right? But it's brutal in ways that undermine all of the moorings upon which Christian thought is established, right? And so, yeah, there's really no room for a Judeo-Christian God in a Lovecraft's universe, for example. And so all of it is just sort of with the rest of the meaninglessness of human life. Very nihilistic, I think. Carter, you started us off right where I'd like to take that. Yeah.
And if it's almost in a way archetypally, it's almost like an archetypal paganism in some way too. Cause like, when you think about his, like, what's in the background, right? These gods of old who are really not gods. They're just like these primordial, powerful beings that have been exiled to an outer darkness of some kind. I mean, isn't that just Epic of Gilgamesh? Isn't that just Tiamat and right, Marduk? Yeah. Like, this is like the fundamental mythos of every human civilization, the forces of chaos being overcome by the forces of order being imposed on them. But then the forces of chaos are always there waiting to unravel what you've done. I think that's one of the things that it makes it so compelling, is that it's touching on something that's part of all of our myth telling, all of our storytelling back to the earliest time.
Yeah, so you can really ask a lot of really interesting theological questions, I think, by engaging with this fiction that does not assume your worldview, right? But it challenges your worldview as a Christian person to, in, I think, productive ways if you approach it on its own terms, right? And it kind of puts you in a position where you have to think about your faith in new and in productive ways. And so, yeah, I'm a big fan. And so so I think we should go ahead and get into the stories just to put some flesh to the bones that we've just established here. So David, your story that you chose was by M.R. James, and it's called Count Magnus. And it's a really terrific ghost story that contains a lot of elements, and I'll just sort of turn it over to you. You can talk us through the story, talk us through some things that you think are interesting or significant about it, and then we'll see where we go.
Yeah, just a brief introduction to the author. M.R. James was himself a scholar by trade. He was an expert on medieval manuscripts. So you can go find M.R. James articles, but they mostly consist of catalogs of manuscripts that he had found in obscure kind of manor house libraries and, you know, sort of tucked away in you know, various spots in England. He was all about kind of finding all the hidden written records of that had survived, especially from the Middle Ages. He was especially an expert in apocrypha and pseudepigrapha, which is one of the reasons why I encountered him. He's especially interested in the ways that non-canonical scriptures and scare quotes show up in England's medieval manuscript record. But he had a tradition that developed in his school. He was at Cambridge, where he would write ghost stories for Christmas parties.
Yeah, that was a thing, right? Christmas ghost stories was a thing, right? Thus the Christmas Carol. But go ahead.
and that Christmas song that talks about ghost stories that never made sense to me. I'm like, who tells ghost stories at Christmas? What's wrong with you people?
Yeah,
everybody apparently. We've all been doing it wrong. No, I totally reread M.R. James at Christmas. It's one of my traditions. So M.R. James ghost stories are often featuring a protagonist who's a scholar, who's doing research, and in the course of their research, they discover something connected to a past that isn't quite as dead as we'd like it to be. So Count Magnus, and I'm going to try to summarize it as briefly as I can. Count Magnus is a found manuscript story. The narrator is someone who has discovered this document hidden in the wall of a house. And the document itself is the notes of someone like 40 years before, something like that, notes which this other person had prepared, a fellow by the name of Raxel, had prepared for a travel book about Sweden. So maybe we'll say something about travel literature later on, but part of writing a travel book at that time meant you had to go and you had to see people and have interesting conversations and see interesting things and write a bunch of kind of natural description and architectural description, sort of some history on the fly. And this guy Raxel is kind of waiting, this noble family who lives at this big manor house in Sweden is letting him read their old family letters and look through their library. It's cool stuff. But along the way, he keeps finding these pieces of an ancestor of the family named Count Magnus, who lived back in the 1600s. And the more he finds out about Magnus, the more fascinated he is by him. And there's actually a mausoleum attached to this local church building that has the grave, the tomb of Count Magnus in it. And at different points in the story, as he's uncovering more and more about the dark secrets of this horrible guy, he keeps revisiting the tomb. And as he revisits the tomb, he'll catch himself muttering, "I wish I could see you, Count Magnus. I wish we could meet, Count Magnus." And whenever he says this, another padlock falls off the coffin.
Yeah.
So eventually, he discovers that Count Magnus had some kind of dark occult secret, that he has these ancient tomes of kind of alchemy and hermetic lore, with cool names. And he'd gone on this thing called the Black Pilgrimage, which is only hinted at, but apparently involves going to what was then the Holy Land, but visiting the unholy sites. And along the way, to have acquired a friend. So at the third time that Mr. Raxel invokes Count Magnus, the third padlock falls. And he finds his steps dogged by two mysterious figures, a taller one in a black cloak and a hat, and then a smaller one in what looks like a dark robe with a hood. And he's called back to England on business, and yet he finds these figures are always with him. Whenever he counts how many people are on the boat or wherever, there's always too shy of those two figures. Like they never come up in the count, but yet they're always there. And in the end, apparently they get him. And that is left for the narrator who's found this manuscript, to sort of question the local people about whether or not they remember this guy who'd taken refuge in this house. And they did, and there were awful rumors still about how he looked when he was dead, but not a lot of detail on that. The weirdness of this one has especially to do with that those hints of the occult with the old books, the Black Pilgrimage, the apparent demon familiar of Magnus, and the fact that Magnus himself is apparently some kind of an undead, not a vampire. He's not sucking anybody's blood. He's more like an undead voyeur. He just likes to watch his familiar eat people. So and just why does this fit into weird fiction? The one thing that he notes, that Mr. Raxel notes about this weird hooded figure, the familiar of Count Magnus, is that dangling from one of his sleeves is what looks like the tentacle of a devilfish. Or not. So, tentacles. We got tentacles, y'all.
Before Lovecraft, as you pointed out to me before the show, though, right? And so this... what is it about octopi? Like, or arthropods in general? Like, what is it that makes them the symbol of cosmic horror, I guess? Honestly, I have to say, so in conspiracy land... that I have a foot in sometimes two. There's a thought that octopuses or octopi are actually alien beings that were like seeded in the oceans and actually are not native to our world. Right. So there is something alien. There's something so alien about their nature that, people don't even think of them as consistent with the rest of God's creation, right? You know, and so, or terrestrial creation at least. And so, is that it? Or like, what is it about? What is it about tentacles?
Yeah, I think that could be part of it. In fact, there's science fiction that they try to find the most alien way, or the way to, make their extraterrestrials as alien as possible. And oftentimes it is with something like tentacles. I think it's because it's so unlike the rest of the created order, right? Like even between bipeds and quadrupeds, we have limbs that have, you know, a palm of sorts, digits of sorts, right? Yeah. There's familiarity, there's similarity. These creatures are like squid and octopus or octopi are pretty unique as far as I know. They're just, I guess to me, there's like this familiarity that they lack. They're amorphous. They're without a lot of definition. And then their limbs are so different from the limbs of other things. And I mean, limbs are sort of, there's something you look to as iconically human, right? The hand, something like that. They strike me as very, I think they strike us as unsettling because they are so weird. Mm. Well, I shouldn't use that word because it has a very specific meaning in this episode.
But it fits, though. But it works, though.
It does, right?
Yeah. It's weird in that
sense. They're just so strange. They don't fit the rest of our experience of creation. They're very unique in that way. And like I said, I kind of find them unsettling when I think about it.
Yeah.
You think about 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, even with the giant squid. It's what's more terrifying than these eyes that are in what's essentially not even a face. It's like this faceless entity, but it still has eyes and it still has limbs, but it lacks definition.
Yeah.
It lacks identity according to the forms that we're used to. So that's kind of how I would go after that.
And weird is the right word, because it picks up on like Mark Fisher's ontological definition of weird. It's like something from another world, and therefore it feels unsettling to ours. It's disturbing, perturbing to our world. Yeah. And David had brought that up, and I had just sort of assumed that for some reason I didn't look at the date, and I didn't realize this was before Lovecraft. This is before Lovecraft did anything with that, right? You know what I mean? And so there is no Cthulhu yet. And so yeah, I think it is fascinating that little moment is thrown in there.
David. Another one, though, just to tip our hat at H.G. Wells, War of the Worlds.
Yes.
When the cylinders fall from Mars, or are shot from Mars, and unscrew, what comes out are giant kind of amorphous cephalopod looking creatures. Mm-hmm. That people call them, people are calling them octopuses.
Mm-hmm.
Octopi. I think they're actually saying octopuses. Mm. You know, the descriptions of tentacles. And one of the things that I feel like I see Wells hiding behind this. Is Wells describes in that moment when when the cylinders are unscrewing and all the crowds are breathlessly watching to see what Martians come out, is that everyone, including the narrator, expects to see a human figure.
Mm.
They had just assumed that the shape of intelligent life elsewhere would be in our shape. Maybe some differences, but that's the silhouette they expect. That's the shape they expect, and that is not what comes out.
They've been watching too much Star Trek, in other words.
right? Like, you know, so many of the aliens I grew up with are just dudes in a suit, and there's something, I don't know, strangely comforting, something that your brain can encompass about a guy in a suit. Yeah. You know, you can just sort of tell yourself, oh, well, it's still just a guy in a suit.
It's Klaatu from that movie. What's the name of that movie? Yeah. That classic sci-fi movie.
Day of the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another bit that I was thinking of, too, and maybe it's just because I've been doing some writing on this lately, but I'm thinking in terms of sensory input, right? So, like, we talked about how they look strange. I was also thinking about audibly, if you hear, let's say you get an octopus out of water, the sound that the tentacles make slapping against the surface, right? Like, just like it, I can't, it's hard, I wouldn't try to demonstrate it because it would just be weird, but but if you can imagine that, if you can imagine what an octopus would sound like moving across the ground with its tentacles, it would be terrifying.
Yeah,
it's just strange. And the tentacles are so all over, like, you can't, again, I think there's this amorphous lack of definition thing that just is frightful, because you can't, it's like you can't understand it, because you can't get your metaphorical hands around it.
Yeah,
because it's something else.
Yeah.
And even just, like I said, the sound, I feel like, would just be grotesque in a way.
It's interesting, just to follow both of those thoughts up, there's an interesting twist on this in the, I've not read it, but the movie version of Arrival. I know that Book of Nature did a show on the book version of it, but with Amy Adams, the aliens are tentacled aliens, right? And the point of that movie is to establish communication. So sound and you know, how communication, they communicate through basically sign language. Right. And so, but that the point of that movie in many ways is to kind of reverse the alien nature of cephalopods, right? Of octopi. And so it's picking up on a kind of an innate fear we have of this alien other from another ontology, and trying to kind of bring them peacefully into our own world. And so that movie really makes more sense in context with the abject fear that this kind of fiction uses or depicts with them. So, David, can I ask you one question about your story? I think that one thing that stood out to me was the way we've been talking about how this is like, this fiction generally is a kind of, It almost assumes that the Christian metaphysic doesn't exist. This particular story doesn't necessarily do that. I almost feel like it's a series of inversions of Christian metaphysics, and that you have this pilgrimage. It's a dark pilgrimage. There's the three padlocks. It's almost like Peter's denial inverted, right? And so I think that, do you have any thoughts on that?
So Lovecraft's ideas about weird fiction haven't been written yet, right? When James is writing these stories, James is a much more of an old-fashioned ghost storyteller. But there's some ways in which the story, I think, edges towards Lovecraft's ideas of weird fiction.
Yeah.
In terms of the classic ghost story, there is still the old house with the old family secret, the delving into family lore. There's also, I mean, as you say, there's those references to Christianity, but they're inversions. It's as if you want to pursue alignment with the dark powers, it involves a kind of reversed parody of the tropes of Christianity. You know, think like the Black Mass and, you know, sort of the classic literature of Satan worship and whatnot. And this is a lot of what the witch trials assumed, right? You know, back at the early modern witch trials, we're all assuming that witchcraft was basically a kind of parodic inversion of Christianity, taking its tropes, taking its symbols, and turning them on their heads. So this story is in that vein, but among the ways that it moves beyond that. This is not a little devil with horns. He's got that tentacle, that bit of, what does he even look like, right? What? But all we know is that he has this feature that we don't expect based on the kind of darkness and the kind of monstrous that comes out of the Catholic and Christian Middle Ages. Also, when he gets you, he doesn't haunt you. This isn't sort of the classic ghost story. He died of fright or any of that stuff. He takes your face off.
Yes.
Right. There's this description, you know, from many generations back that the innkeeper tells Mr. Raxel about these guys who go to hunt in Count Magnus's woods after Count Magnus is dead, and people hear their screams, and when they come out the next day to find their bodies, because they just assume those guys are dead, one of the fellas just doesn't have a face anymore. His eyes are staring up at the sky because he didn't have lids to close them anymore. And the villagers, they cannot handle this. So this is not just a supernatural threat. It's a physical threat, but it's a physical threat that's beyond and different from even what we can parse and hypothesize about, right? They weren't torn limb from limb by werewolves.
Right.
They weren't bitten by vampires. They weren't stabbed or shot or burned or... How do you even do that?
Yeah.
And what is he doing with the face afterwards?
Yeah.
Right?
There's a sequel waiting here.
Does he have a collection? Does he wear them? Right. It's much more corporeal.
Yeah. It's Jeepers Creepers, the movie, right? Yeah.
I was just thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. In interest of getting through all these, I hate to like leave one. I feel like we could talk about each of these stories for the entire hour, but
you know, right?
Kid has a play date.
We'll leave Magnus behind.
But no, that's great. And feel free to keep chiming in here. I'm going to real quickly talk about H.P. Lovecraft's Pickman's model. It's very recognizably H.P. Lovecraft in that you have somebody with knowledge that they're sorry they have, telling the story about how this has driven them crazy and now they can't ride in the subway anymore, right? And so there's that's very recognizably H.P. Lovecraft in that way. It does not have the tentacled Cthulhu gods, right? This is a different sort of monstrosity that this is dealing with. The story revolves around this dude whose I think his name is Thurber. I think we referenced him once in the story. And he's sort of talking to this the audience of this is Elliot. And so we're feeling as if we are Elliot. And he's telling us the story about their mutual acquaintance, Pickman, who is an artist. So you're imagining this like art scene in Boston in which there's like prestige involved and talent and commerce are all coming together and with building the institution of high art. And Pickman is an extremely talented version of that person, but is drawn to the dark stuff. So the stuff that he's drawing is weird fiction, the artistic, the fine art version of weird fiction. And he gets kind of ostracized from the straight community here, if you will, of the artists. And so the narrator Thurber has this kind of relationship. He's really admires Pickman's work and sort of continues this relationship with him. And Pickman agrees to take him to his secret studio in the north end of Boston. So we're kind of described, and I've actually done this before when I've taught this story. You can actually find the streets that he's talking about on the map. If you just pull up Google Maps, it really does exist. I'm sure it doesn't look like what he's, depicting in this story, but there's there's a place in the kind of slums, the old part of the city that Pickman is drawn to because it allows access through its very architecture to this underworld where these creatures exist, right? And we don't know this until the end, but the idea is Thurber is introduced into this world. He goes into one of these cellars and there's a noise. He's ushered out. Pickman shoots something that he says it was rats, whatnot. And Thurber is like basically telling Elliot that I found a picture of one of these monsters. They really exist. He's not drawing this from imagination. So this is not a plot driven story, right? It's a depiction of a moment almost. And so, what stands out to me about the story, in addition to the kind of typical weird fiction in which a person is introduced to a world that shouldn't exist, but its existence challenges everything they know about their own world. He refuses to go into cellars now. He refuses to go into subways because anything under the ground is where this evil dwells, right? And so that's very weird fiction-y, right? But it's also dealing with kind of abject spaces. If you think about in psychological terms, this is a very horror concept where the abject is that which civilization needs to expel in order to be civilization, right? Pickman himself is that, and his art is that, and his art actually comes from one of these older kind of abject spaces, and it really invigorates his art into this like kind of astonishing like realism of this world that shouldn't exist, right? And it hinted at throughout in phrases here and there that Pickman himself is like a descendant of these folks. Like when he has an ancestor who is hung as a witch in the Salem witch trials. And one of the figures has a vague resemblance to Pickman. There's some interesting depictions of the changeling in which the monsters steal human babies and leave monster babies in the cribs. And the changeling is depicted in this. And so there's some hints that Pickman himself comes from the underworld and has been sort of introduced to our world, and he freaks everybody out, and then he sort of disappears back into the underworld, just long enough to educate our Thurber about the true nature of reality and that life as he knows it is meaningless because it's all just going to just collapse as soon as these monsters emerge from the underground. And so those are sort of the aspects of this story that stand out to me. Did you guys have any thoughts about it?
This is my favorite Lovecraft story. Just as you were talking, I'm learning a little bit more. That makes me appreciate it even more. But it seems to me like the way that Pickman's an outcast, the spaces you're talking about, these derelict spaces are basically outcast spaces.
Yeah.
They're wastelands. But what always really stood out to me with Lovecraft was his depictions of Boston and, well, Arkham, which is a fictional Massachusetts. That's always stood out to me because it's kind of like the closest thing to an old world we have in the United States, yeah. right? It's not, I live in Washington State, so like everything here is infant compared to the rest of the country. But, you know, I lived on the East Coast for a little bit, and some of the cities are very old. And what city is more old than a Massachusetts city, like Boston?
Yeah.
It's the way he describes it, the way he sort of expresses it makes it, it connects back to what the early settlers, like the Puritans, would have been thinking when they looked into the dark forest and when they thought about witches and things like that. It actually made me think of the movie The Witch.
Yeah.
I read it. Is that there's this terror that they have of the unknown out there because they're all alone in this place, except that the terror is actually real. And it's just so he's kind of like hearkening back to I like how we hearken back to those old American, that setting, and sort of puts you in that atmosphere and tries to tell you, well, this is actually true. We didn't actually escape this. It's still there. It's just under this veneer of civilization that we think has drowned all that out.
Yeah, let me just kind of quote from the story a little bit. You know, he said, there are things that won't do for Newberry Street. That's where the high artists live, right? Things that are out of place here and that can't be conceived here anyhow. It's my business to catch the overtones of the soul, and you won't find those in a parvenu set of artificial streets on made land. Back Bay isn't Boston. It isn't anything yet because it has no time to pick up memories and attract local spirits. And later on, the place for an artist to live is the North End. If any aesthete were sincere, he'd put up with the slums for the sake of the massed traditions. God, man, don't you realize that places like that weren't merely made, but actually grew? Generation after generation lived and felt and died there, right? And so there's this idea that this old city is connected to something primordial, right? And is, again, like if you go to Florida, it feels like everything was made 10 days ago, right? And so it's hard
to... Unless you're in St. Augustine.
True. It's hard to imagine a ghost story taking place believably in Florida because there's no memory there, right? This is a place with memory and a memory that civilization wants to forget, right? The high culture, civilization wants to have moved on beyond it, right? And so, and pretend that it doesn't exist. And that, and Pickman's seeming emergence from there and return to there makes him kind of an outcast and an abject member of society. And so, yeah, I think that that's a feature of weird fiction, is this kind of civilization versus its other, and that dichotomy. And I think that you see that even though there aren't tentacles per se, you have sort of dog creatures in this one. So, David, did you have any thoughts?
I mean, I just want to name, something that y'all both been referencing, which is this sense that the story, builds on the sense of deep history and deep past.
Yeah.
Which is, that's the Gothic, right?
Yeah.
Gothic literature is all about how the crumbling remains of the past are still with us, and these architectural remains, these sort of structural remnants are symbols of other remnants that are still here. They might be dark sins of the past that still linger in even the physical DNA of the family. Like that's the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah,
the
true.
Hound of Baskervilles is a scientific Gothic tale in which the family curse is literally a lineage of crime. You know, that sense that the back in history, there are shadows, there are dark places, there are things that we want to keep hidden, but all that is hidden will come to light. And when it does, you won't like it. And so, you know, all three of our stories that we're looking at really are stories of dark past that come back to haunt the present. And you have to actually rethink the past,
yeah,
in order to solve the problem in the present, which is really why the hero of Count Magnus can't win.
True.
He's just one little guy. He doesn't have any competent allies. He can't get away.
Yeah.
In Pikmin, have y'all read The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath?
No.
Okay.
I can't remember.
It's one of Lovecraft's long Dreamland stories. Pigman shows up in it.
Oh, interesting.
As a ghoul.
Oh.
As a ghoul.
He went to go live with the ghouls. He was transformed, and in the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, he features as basically a king or chieftain of ghouls, leading this army of ghouls to help the protagonist in his quest.
Oh, that is fascinating. Oh, yeah. That's great. I will definitely have to check that out. Yeah,
that'll be my next read.
Yeah, absolutely. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. And so another feature of this then that we kind of see in this, in both these stories, in all three of these stories, is that there is a past that to understand it is to be kind of partially destroyed, right? I mean, it's you kind of lose at least touch with sanity, if not your life, by coming into touch with this ancient evil past. And that's why so many of the protagonists of these stories, and particularly in Lovecraft, are scholars who have discovered some manuscript, and that discovery has driven them crazy, right? It's like going into a PhD program, really. And so, and it's a really nice transition into Carter's story. Carter, you have a Robert E. Howard story called Pigeons from Hell. And I really loved reading it. There's a lot of disturbing connotations, I think, or implications in this story that we'll probably get to, but I want to hear what you have to say about this story.
Okay. So Pigeons from Hell, Robert E. Howard, to give a little background, is going to be different than some of the other weird fiction writers in a few ways. One, he's a younger writer. Than the other two, of course. He's young, and when he starts, he's young as he starts his writing, and he's young compared to Lovecraft. Although they did have some correspondence through their life, or through before Lovecraft died. I think Lovecraft died before Howard, but Howard died very young. He was very attached to his mother. In fact, after she died, he committed suicide at age of 36, I want to say. But he's from Texas. He's a Texan, and so he's very much a Southerner. The stories that he writes about America are mostly take place in the South, because he tends to write about what he knows. But Howard has a very different approach to his protagonists, where he touches on some of these same weird themes. Lovecraft seems like he kind of puts himself into his characters. They're scholars. They're a little more nerdy, limp noodle type of men, I think we might say. Howard has a weird sort of, I think I'd call it misogynistic, but I'm not sure. A very, very ancient view of masculinity. And I say ancient rather than antiquated, because I think he's thinking of masculinity much further back than like 1900s America. He's thinking like Gilgamesh. He's thinking Hercules. He's thinking a person whose physical prowess is what really matters, not their intellect. And not in the at least their intellect is not a scholarly intellect. It's always like a practical intellect, if I could put it that way.
He's not woke, right? Robert E. Howard is not woke.
Because all the women swoon as soon as they encounter him, right? He doesn't need to be woke. Yeah.
This is the guy who wrote Conan the Barbarian, right?
And so, Conan the Barbarian. Yeah, so. And Conan is a fascinating... I love those stories, mainly for the adventure and the violence, if I'm honest. They're fun. They're really fun to read, but as I've gotten older, as I've thought about gender roles and things, now when I go back to them, I'm like, oh goodness, it's so much harder for me to enjoy these now. But so I have to let them be what they are, and I still enjoy them for the fantasy elements, right? But the thing is that, and I want to mention this because it plays into this story as well, his protagonists are always physically capable. They're clever and intelligent in a non-academic way, and that's actually what allows them not to be overcome by these fearful deep evils or deep chaos things. It's because they have a very practical view of the world. They kind of already know that they don't understand it. And so when they encounter these things, they just kill them. Like, I don't really care what it is. I don't care where it's from. I don't have to comprehend it as long as it can die. And so very rarely will you get a situation where a Howard character loses their mind or goes mad, like in Lovecraft. He seems to see that as not really a problem. The only problem for his protagonist is, can I kill it?
Yeah.
So that's an important feature, because you're not going to get the same end result as you do with the Magnus story, or with the James story, or with the Lovecraft story.
He's the Duck Dynasty of weird fiction.
You just ruined him for me.
I wish I could trace it down, but I read somewhere that the difference between weird horror and sword and sorcery as genres is whether or not you have a competent protagonist.
Maybe so. Yes.
That's a good point. Every time, you know, like Conan or Solomon Kanan or any of these Howard characters encounter something like that, they just fight it, and either they end up having to escape from it, or they find some clever way of killing it, right? And so that's what we get in Pigeons from Hell. So Pigeons from Hell is a really fascinating story, and it's doing the same thing with sort of the deep historical past that we've talked about, except that instead of the New England, or instead of the Swedish or old European ancient past or deep past, this is the deep past of the South.
Yeah.
And so it comes with all of the racial issues that arise from that. It's a little hard to pin Howard down on race. He's very much a man of his time. In the version I have, he does not hesitate to use racial epithets colloquially, just like it doesn't matter. And yet at the same time, he seems to be somewhat tuned in to the fact that there are sins that were committed racially against people. So again, he's a man of his time. He's by no means a Black Lives Matter right, progressive. But and he's racist is what I'm saying. You know, it's not
close. Yeah.
but not
he's racist. He's racist in a way that's, I think, a little more nuanced than someone who would be like, you know, really. He understands, or at least seems to recognize, the complexity in that whites have treated terribly those who were not.
Yeah.
So. And that's actually where the story gets its interest for me. So the story, basically, you got these brothers traveling through the deep South, and I can't remember. I think it's Louisiana. Everything always in his stories, it's always Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, because that's what he knows. I believe this is Louisiana.
Pine woods, I think.
I
think they're up in the piney woods of East Texas. I want to say that's where they're at.
That sounds right.
Okay, you might be right. I read this again about a couple of weeks ago, and for some reason I just didn't see that. But they're in the old South, in that Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana area there, and I think you're right, because it's very forested. So these two brothers are traveling. They're just on a road trip, right? Those never end badly in these types of stories. And they come across this old derelict house, this mansion, and they go to stay there in the night, right? Nothing bad ever happens there either. Everything's checking out so far. They go to sleep on the floor in the basement. And as I recall, the character who survives, spoilers, Griswell, he awakes, and he's sort of like, sort of the story starts, it sort of drops you in. He awakes and he kind of isn't remembering where he is, and there's some sounds and he's freaked out. And what he does is he looks up the stairs of this old Southern mansion, and his brother's walking down the mansion or down the stairs. His head has been split essentially as with an axe, and he's carrying the axe.
Yeah.
And so Griswell does what any person would do, and he runs, terrified, screaming, right, from the house. He's the one who almost loses his mind, right? He's this soft New Englander who doesn't, who can't handle the harsh realities of real life. And as he's running, he encounters the real hero of the story, which is Bucknell. Bucknell is, he appears in one other, actually, Howard story Buckner. Sorry, it's Buckner. Buckner appears in one other Howard story that is in the collection I have. So he's only recurring in those stories as far as I know, though. But he's a Southern sheriff, essentially. He's got a six shooter. He's classic cowboy type of thing. And Buckner says, okay, well, we have to check it out. So they go back, and the brother is just dead on the floor. And so, of course, Buckner just assumes at that point that his brother, that the Griswold killed his brother and is a murderer. And he's like, he has to deal with it on that basis. But when Griswold starts describing what's happened and what he encountered, Buckner starts, he's got these memories of stories, right? He knows that there's these stories told about this house, about something strange. And he wants to do justice and investigate it. So they go talk to an old voodoo man, right? So you've already got this sort of Haitian slave trade, old Africa sorcery thing in the background. Howard draws that in a number of places. And the old voodoo man tells him essentially there was this family in this house, and one of the women in the house was just utterly cruel to the slaves. She was horrendous to them. But one of the slaves was actually practiced in voodoo, and that she had placed, the voodoo slave girl had placed a curse on the house. The sisters, or because I think it was sisters who lived in the house, they all die, right? And eventually he says that she still remains there. Just, it's sort of left vague who the she is, right? So they assume this is the voodoo woman is there as a, what they call a Zuvembi.
Yeah. Like a female zombie?
A female zombie. Okay. Right. Yeah. I never heard it until I encountered the story, and yeah. I've never seen it since.
Me neither.
That seems to be the,
this is Robert Howard's invention.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Cause I was totally new to me. Okay.
Yeah. And then immediately he's bitten by a snake and dies, a poisonous snake, because he apparently was not supposed to share this knowledge. And
with, so with white people.
With white people, yes. Exactly. So there's already, this is 1920s, 1930s, there's already sort of like this, hey, we still have these very sort of like isolated racial cloisters. And that plays into the other story that with this Buckner character, it deals with like back swamp, Louisiana voodoo sorcery going on, and the blacks are going to rise up with their pagan magic and come after us and all this stuff. So it ties in with the other story, and it's kind of in the same theme. Anyway, they go back to the house. They want to investigate. What ends up happening is Griswold is hypnotized and is walking up the stairs. Buckner follows him. Discovers that it is in fact the Zuvembi is there. He kills her, and they find this little room that she had been staying in. But what they discover is that the Zuvembi was not the voodoo slave woman. It was the owner who had been so cruel and terrible to her slaves, right? And the pigeons from hell part is that there's these pigeons that hang out outside the house that are supposedly the souls of the white family who had lived there.
Also very Jeepers Creepers. There's lots of birds. There's lots of birds outside the cave in Jeepers Creepers that seemingly represent the souls of those. So I'm sorry.
Digression. That's great.
Yeah.
So the thing I really like about this story, and the thing that makes me say that Robert E. Howard, racist, but complicated, is that this really is this story really reflects on sort of the racial sins of the past and what's been, you know, what a group of people have done to another group of people, what whites have done to blacks. What makes it weird fiction is this sort of underlying world that we don't understand, right? There's the voodoo magic that the whites just can't get their heads around. They don't get it, but it still exists, and it manipulates the world in a way that we can't quite understand. And then the Zuvembi, this sort of primal horror, this thing that we don't know what it is. We can't really explain it. But we know it only intends evil for the living or for normal people. it's overcome in the end, but the thing that's really interesting to me is who is for Howard, who receives the punishment, right? You go into the story reading and you're thinking it's this slave woman who's performed this black magic or whatever. She's the one being punished. She's the one who has to live out eternity as this horrid zombie creature, preying on poor innocent New Englanders who wander into abandoned houses. but what it ends up being is the punishment, the horrid existence is actually the white owner who was cruel to her slaves. It's the person who deserves it, in other words, and she's the one who has to live out the existence, preying on the innocent and being this evil, this primal evil force that is eventually done away with. And so it's almost like this weird, well, it's this really interesting, in the context of weird fiction, it's this really interesting reflection on, I think, the sins of the South, the sins of Americans, racial sins. It's Howard's, to me, it seems like Howard is kind of like thinking through that and reflecting on that in the context of this dark magic story. And coming to it, to me, it's a sort of interesting, complicated conclusion that the person who suffers for the sin, for the oppression, is less the oppressed, and in some sense more the oppressor. So that was kind of where I went with this story. What do you guys think?
David, do you want to go first?
Yeah, who's the monster?
Yeah.
And Miss Celia's the monster.
Yeah.
I've been through the Piney Woods in that kind of we drove through there on our way home from Christmas. So we'd been planning this episode, and a lot of his, I don't remember this particular story, but a lot of his stories centering around voodoo and kind of rural settings are in that kind of East Texas, West Louisiana, Piney Woods area. It's actually kind of a creepy place still.
It's abject, right? Yeah.
a lot of the, I love the sort of the local, that local history vibe. And I love the way Howard, you know, he's a disciple of Lovecraft, but he's going to do it in his way. And even though he's got this token Lovecraftian protagonist in there, in Griswell, the spineless guy who's going to go mad when he sees the horrors, he's got to get his own Howard protagonist in there too. And I would read so many more stories with Buckner. He's cool.
Absolutely, yeah.
I love the scene where Buckner is basically doing sort of his Western CSI.
Yeah.
And kind of tracing the blood, looking at the footprints, and basically confirming that the evidence that I see indicates that what happened is something that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
That I think is a really cool use of pragmatic details to enhance the sense of the uncanny. Lovecraft and M.R. James are always kind of pulling out old manuscripts and you know, Lovecraft is elevating. He's going to unpack his adjectives.
Yeah.
Howard does it with these very kind of concrete, practical details that his I love what you were saying about his sort of pragmatic macho protagonists. It's a weird tale that's presented in the ways that they're gonna parse it. They're gonna perceive it and be able to understand it, and then in the end shoot it because, yeah, he's still competent. Yeah.
Right. So this is how a Texan would face the terrifying unknown.
Yeah.
Right?
Bang, 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 bang.
David Grubbs from Houston Baptist.
I live in Sugar Land, Texas, which has its name because of the sugar plantations here.
Right.
And the white settlers didn't work their own sugar plantations, y'all.
Yeah.
You know, in Fort Bend County, where I live, there was a proposed building for the school district. But when they were clearing the area, they found in it a kind of impromptu cemetery for prisoners from like 100 years ago who the prison system would basically lease prison labor for the sugar plantations. And these guys often died doing it. And they were, they were disproportionately African American. So, I mean, the region that I live in is still uncovering these dark pasts.
The Clintons did that. The Clintons did that when they were governor of Arkansas. I mean, they had prison labor working in the governor's mansion, right? And that came out in like Hillary's book. I do believe.
Yeah. They didn't like die and bury him.
Well, no. No, but it was essentially, So, let's not divert. I have 7 minutes before I have to leave. And so let's not go there. But one thing, so this story was really fascinating, and I was only really familiar with Howard's sword and sorcery stuff. Right. And so, what was really interesting, I felt like when I was reading this, the next time I teach A Rose for Emily, I want to teach this together. I feel like it would be a really interesting, pairing of stories to talk about the South's legacy of racial sin, and supernatural, recompense that the way it's dealt with that. I'm not exactly sure what I think about it, because I feel like Howard thinks he's being progressive in terms of like ultimately the white people are punished for the sin of holding slaves and being mean to the slaves, right? I feel like what's really underneath this is that they're really being punished for having any dealings with Africans who are innately evil and into voodoo and black magic, right? And so I feel like it's almost like they're punished. The evil is contained. The evil is coded as black in this. I mean, it just so happens that the escaped slave, I can't remember if she was freed at that point or not, cursed the white slave owner with the black curse, right? Everyone had just assumed she had become the Zubembe herself and cursed and killed the family, but she poisoned basically the mean slaveholder lady with the curse of blackness, I think on some level it appears to be more progressive than it is. I think underneath it is still a really virulent racism about.
Oh yeah,
as you said,
I've read a lot of Howard, that is very characteristic of him.
So yeah, but a fascinating story. We're not afraid on this show of reading, you know, non-PC fiction, right? And this is definitely not PC fiction, and so
nope. Not by a long shot.
Yeah, but it is fascinating, and it opens up a really fascinating conversation. And I would love to see what students did with this in conversation with A Rose for Emily. I think it would be a really fascinating comparison.
Well, and it's important to recognize that this is the 1930s. This is not written back in the 1850s or something. That these racial the ideas of Howard, these deeply racist ideas are very clearly present in the 1930s and widespread enough that his stories will have a popular readership and not be questioned, really.
Yeah.
It didn't run in like the Klan Weekly.
True.
No, this was in a widely, sold.
And Lovecraft himself, Lovecraft too, was very anti-Semitic and also very racist. And so there's something about that time and maybe this genre that encourages that sort of thing. And it's an interesting document of it nonetheless. And I think it is really fascinating. I really had a great time talking to you guys about this. This was so much fun. Do you guys have any last thoughts do you want to get to before we leave?
We're bringing up the ways in which these are artifacts of a different time in our society. They are, in a sense, also functionally are Gothic, right? And engaging with these stories helps us not to bury the past. Sometimes the reaction to a past of bigotry is to gloss over it and just not talk about it. But in some sense, to re-engage with these stories it's a very Christian thing to do if it's functioning as confession. And that's what I want to, I'm glad that we're doing this over the course of this episode. I've read Robert Howard and enjoyed it. I've read H.P. Lovecraft and enjoyed it. But I also do need to confess, these stories manifest something that's ugly in our culture and is still there. And maybe not exactly in all of the same ways, but naming it is important.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, I would agree with that. I also think that it's an interesting point of something like Howard and Lovecraft are interesting points of contact with people who might otherwise not be, who might otherwise be pretty resistant to religion, because these guys are not religious. Mm. They're Lovecraft is very outspokenly atheistic, and yeah. Yet these are people who recognize the unknown, recognize that there are things inexplicable and perhaps even mysterious and out there and beyond. And so I find that an interesting dialogue partner, because it's almost like they're trying to create a metaphysic without metaphysics. They're trying to create a metaphysic without God. And so I think it's an interesting entry point to think about how do we make myths? How do we tell stories about ourselves? And how do we see the universe, the cosmos? And trying to interact with a way of seeing it that's thoroughly modern, thoroughly atheistic, but also at the same time recognizing the unknowability of the world. I don't know. I find that a sort of a fascinating thought experiment. Along with that, again, as David was saying, it gives you that picture into a time and place where we can grapple with who we were and who we still are in some ways, grapple with our social and societal sins, whether it's gender or race or whatever. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well said. And I'll try to find links to these stories that are publicly available and put them on the show notes at sectarianreviewpodcast.com. But, I really can't thank you guys enough. This was so much fun. I really had a great time talking to you guys about these stories. I had not read either of the two that you chose for us, but they were both really terrific and fascinating. Those of you who are listening, if you have any questions and you want to kind of talk back to us, by all means, you know where to find us at sectarianreviewpodcast.com. The Facebook page is always a great place to find us. Twitter, email, whatever. So we're very, very welcome or open to a conversation with our listeners. And so please take part of that. If you have any further thoughts on what we've talked about here today, we'd love to hear it. So I want to thank Carter Stepper and David Grubbs of the Christian Humanist Podcast for joining me today to talk about weird fiction. Thanks for listening and catch you next time.